Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
There are some things between American politics right now and this American economy of ours that just don't add up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 7th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to begin today by pointing out a series of disconnects. There are, as we saw yesterday, some disconnects within our democracy, but there are also pretty clearly some disconnects between this democracy and this economy, between the stock markets and the economy, and between the markets and our democracy. Might I point out, just for instance, record highs on Wall Street yesterday and then again today amid insurrection in the Capitol building and talk of the 25th Amendment. So we got on the phone today and asked some people some questions. Basically, what do you make of this? And we started with Andrea Eisfeldt. She's at the Anderson School out at UCLA.
Many bad pieces of news have come out over the last year or so that have just not been able to put a dent in the valuations of the companies that are driving these indices.
The pandemic and the recession and political lies and George Floyd and everything and nary a hiccup from the markets, because traders are just looking at other things like the Fed.
We are going to see government support probably in the form of low rates for quite some time.
Free money, right? And now after Democratic wins in Georgia, Congress.
And now we do see potential situation in the Senate where we might see some more fiscal spending as well.
Fiscal spending relief, of course. But Gary Hoover at Tulane points out the markets aren't really about today so much.
The markets are saying, okay, this is the last hurrah, as violent as it was. But with the ratification for President-elect Biden, that they see more stable times in the future.
And let us not forget this from Andrea Eisfeldt. Again, she's at UCLA.
Stock market participation is a minority of the U.S. population, and the correlation between stock market participation and the way this economy has treated you is positive.
If you're in the market, basically, you're doing all right. But if you are not, if you're the people left out of all that market optimism, they're the people left out of recoveries. Here's Gary Hoover one more time.
My biggest concern is the disproportionate impact that this is going to have on people of color, specifically African Americans.
As I said, record highs on Wall Street today, disconnects, and all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we sit here on the 1,448th day of Donald Trump's presidency, he has been, at least temporarily, deplatformed. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg said today the president's account would be suspended indefinitely, but for at least the next 2 weeks. Twitter gave him a 12-hour timeout yesterday. It seems to have been extended for a bit. Other sites, Shopify and Twitch among them, have done the same or similar. So what conclusions might we draw here? Well, when we go looking for tech conclusions to draw, we call Molly Wood. She is the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So here we are, as I said, 1,500-ish days into the Trump presidency, and now Facebook and Twitter have decided, oh, no, I'm sorry, this is too much?
Yeah. I think that the pressure internally at both of those companies definitely got loud, in addition to obviously external pressure. It is a weird situation, and I think everybody would be forgiven for saying, I feel like there's some saying about a horse and a barn door that could be relevant at this moment, because it is obviously not just the president and his platform that has plagued these platforms. It is all kinds of disinformation, hate speech, and organizing of events like the storming of the Capitol on Wednesday.
Right. So let's play that out a little bit. Do you suppose, this is a silly question to ask, even as it comes out of my mouth, do you suppose lessons have been learned?
I think that the lesson that has been learned is this is the end of this presidency. Violence was committed. 4 people died. You know, this is really a serious event that should be a lesson teacher, but I don't think that we can ignore the fact that a new administration is coming in, that calls for regulation on these platforms have gotten a lot stronger, and that it is a very good time to take this kind of action, especially if you want to protect yourself in the future. And look, the immunity law that everybody talks about, Section 230, It does not protect platforms from illegal actions by their users. And so let's just say it's a wise choice on a lot of levels.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so I want to get to, we got like a minute and a half tops, maybe a minute. I have to point out here that Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, the senators who raised and voted for objections, are still online. The 120-something members of the House are still online with their doses of disinformation. So that seems to me to be a failing. But 230 and that section of the law that gives the platforms and everybody on them immunity, do you suppose there is a chance for real reform that's going to come out of these events?
I would say that, you know, it's easy to forget, given the events of this week, that the U.S. government is now, you know, all 3 branches are in the hands of Democrats. And if there is going to be reform, it's more likely now than it ever has been. I think the conversation that we are having about speech online is changing, and it's changing fast. It's going to be a while before we can come to an agreement, especially since some of the conspiracy theories that are still being pushed all over these platforms, you know, are firmly believed by members of our government. Yeah. So it's not over.
Yeah. Just because I said the same thing yesterday, it's actually just Congress and the White House that the Democrats have. The Supreme Court is conservative, shall we say.
Oh, yeah. Good point. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, fair enough, right?
Good call. Thanks.
Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech, also with me, a podcast we do. Coming back tomorrow, by the way. It's called Make Me Smart. Thanks, Molly.
Thanks, Kai.
Talk to you soon. We're going to get new numbers for inflation in this economy next week. And if what's passed is actually prologue, there is just not going to be a whole lot of it, except perhaps in food. I mention that because a global food price index out today from the United Nations shows those prices hit a 3-year high last year. Gains in everything from meat and dairy to grains and oils. Not so great for a global and domestic economy trying to recover, as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports.
One of the many foods that's getting more expensive is vegetable oil.
Vegetable oil prices year to year went up 19%. That's quite a bit.
Abdulreza Abbasian is a senior economist at the UN. A big reason, he says, is that China's economy is recovering. The country's been buying a lot more palm oil, which is used in all kinds of household products, including ice cream, detergent, even lipstick. China's also buying more meat, and that means more demand for feed crops, like wheat and soybeans.
So the combination of that has contributed to also higher prices.
Meanwhile, severe summer storms destroyed crops from Iowa to Indiana, and other parts of the country are in the middle of a drought. Naomi Bloom is senior market advisor at Total Farm Marketing.
If the weather doesn't turn around and if this drought isn't alleviated, then we've got an issue.
If bad weather continues, Bloom says supermarket prices could start rising this summer. Harvard economist Kenneth Rogoff says supermarkets don't have much leeway to absorb the costs they pay for food.
When the costs go up, there's just no buffer to protect the consumer, and it gets passed on quite quickly.
And that's unwelcome news in the middle of a recession. Rogoff says price hikes will be hard for people to avoid.
They seem to be traveling less, buying less clothes.
But food, he says, is not an area where people have been cutting back. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When you think about archaeology, you think about some ancient culture when history is yesterday.
History is cool. I am just going to say that here for the record. First, though, I'm going to say this. Let's do the numbers, huh? Nothing but records, as I said. Dow Industrial's up 211, 0.6%, 31,041. The NASDAQ up 326, 2.5%, 13,067. The S&P 500 up 55, 1.4%. 3803, talking about disconnects. As strange as it does feel right now, by the way, business does go on, traders trade. So Walgreens up 5.1% after it beat estimates. Food producer ConAgra beat quarterly profit expectations. Revenue was in line with forecast. ConAgra, should you not be familiar, owns Healthy Choice, Ready Whip, Slim Jim, also Angie's Boom Chicka Pop. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is an entirely non-political event going on in Washington that is going to sound, I warn you, a little geeky, but it is actually going to be really, really important for our online future. It's an auction of the wireless spectrum that mobile companies and media giants are paying top dollar for in the tens of billions of dollars because they are betting big on 5G. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
Building a 5G future is like building a stool, says industry analyst Neil Mostyn at Strategy Analytics. You need three legs.
You need fast 5G networks. You need fast devices like you're seeing from Apple. And you need compelling apps, things like TikTok.
Networks for 5G need wireless airwaves, which are now being auctioned off at the FCC. And the bids from mobile giants like Verizon and AT&T are through the roof, totaling $80 billion so far. It's that valuable to them, the wireless equivalent of beachfront property.
If you want to be on the seafront with the best view, you've got to pay for it.
There is concern that the carriers will get financially overstretched, but the 5G mood is mostly optimistic. The new iPhone 12 became the world's best-selling 5G smartphone in just 2 weeks. And smartphone suppliers are raising their revenue outlooks. Because we, the consumers, are gaga for 5G, right?
This is between you and me and your listeners. 5G is not driving anything right now.
Analyst John Strand at Strand Consult says consumers may not know exactly what 5G is, but...
Basically, you say, it's better to be safe than sorry. You feel like an idiot if you don't buy a 5G phone, if you don't have a 5G phone.
Okay, well, whatever the motivation, 5G devices are moving. And by some estimates, 500 million will sell worldwide in 2021. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The gears of this economy grind on for now, whatever the state of our democracy. Specifically, in this instance, the capital markets, the stock exchanges. There has been a concerted effort over the past year or so by the White House and Congress to get certain Chinese companies kicked out of U.S. stock exchanges. Delisted is the technical term. The New York Stock Exchange has delisted and then listed again, and then, at the urging of the Trump administration, delisted yet again a bunch of Chinese firms, three of them technically. The latest is they will be kicked out as of January the 11th. And now, according to the Wall Street Journal, the administration is debating whether to also push the New York Stock Exchange to remove Alibaba and Tencent. You've heard of them, I'm sure, because they are the biggest of Chinese technology companies. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore looked at what the end game might be here.
So there are a few different motivations here. Congress, in a bill signed in December, went after Chinese companies that don't meet U.S. accounting standards but still sell stocks in the U.S. Paul Triolo is with Eurasia Group.
It can't go on, right? I mean, if Chinese companies are really going to be listing on the New York, on U.S. stock exchanges, they have to abide by these rules.
The president's rationale has been something very different. He wants companies delisted if they're too close to the Chinese military. David Dollar is a senior fellow at Brookings.
It's an effort on the part of the administration to make sure that American investor money is not going to companies that are seen as helping the Chinese military and security apparatus.
But it's not clear that all the companies being targeted actually have much of a connection to the military or the government, which Paul Triolo says calls into question the effectiveness of the president's policy.
What's the goal here? I mean, is delisting some Chinese telecommunications company really have any impact on China's military modernization?
No, says David Dollar.
I think it's a minor annoyance for China.
These companies can get capital elsewhere, potentially from U.S. allies exchanges. Stephanie Siegel is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says if that happens,
we will have undercut U.S. investors, but not ultimately discouraged investment in the company that we're worried about.
Siegel says the Biden administration is very likely to reevaluate this approach. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Mostly out of necessity, because 9 months of this, right? A lot of families have worked out some kind of system, tenuous and imperfect, though it may be, to juggle work and school and pandemic life in general. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has been following some of those families. Here's an update.
Back in the summer, Delane Rouse was considering putting his twin 10-year-old daughters in a learning pod, teaming up with a few other families to manage virtual school together in a small group. But eventually, the Washington, D.C. photographer decided he could handle it himself.
One of the things that I bought early on was a bell, a little ringing bell. You know, when you walk up to the front desk at a hotel and you ring the bell.
The idea was, rather than his daughters screaming across the house every 5 minutes when they needed help, they could ring the bell.
And then I would hop up and run into the bedroom or run to the dining room to help out with tech support. That got old quick.
Turns out they need a lot of help. Even without an obnoxious bell, supervising remote school is pretty distracting. Rouse can only do it because his business taking corporate headshots has unfortunately dried up as executives stay home in sweatpants.
My business is down, last I checked, like 84% for the year.
Meanwhile, in New York, the pandemic has brought new opportunities to Karen Sachs, who also works in commercial photography. She runs a platform that helps women photographers find gigs. The last time we heard from her, she was hiding from her two young kids just to take my call. She worried she wouldn't be able to grow her business with the kids demanding her time.
So we created a pod with some neighbors. So every day we have three children on Zoom with a sitter doing school.
Her three-year-old son had been going to in-person preschool until it closed down because of an outbreak. So she set him up on a laptop next to her desk while she tried to focus on work, until she realized he had been buying and downloading video games, like one called Paw Patrol.
You think you have everything under control. You think that you have figured out your life in the pandemic and things are going smoothly and you can do it all. And then you realize you just can't.
Managing the activities of six kids at home was way too big of a job for Kelly Newman to even attempt to take on while working. Back in the fall, we learned she had quit her job as a family law attorney.
The crisis mode is not what we had planned for our family.
She and her wife have already burned through much of their nest egg, which they'd hoped to put toward buying a home in South New Jersey.
You know, we had hopes and aspirations, and we had hoped that our hard work would pay off.
That goal feels out of reach now. But her new reality does have its rewards.
I can't imagine being out of my house for 12 hours a day, or 13, or 14 by the time we add in the commute. It's amazing to me that I ever did.
She hopes someday she can return to practicing law as her own boss, with a bit more time for her family. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Amy Scott, who covers housing for us, has spent the last couple of months concentrating on a single city block in Baltimore, Maryland, a block that a year ago had been all but abandoned. A legacy of disinvestment and racism and people just leaving. Something that has happened in Baltimore and lots of other cities, too. One of the results of which has been empty housing. Lots of it. But this particular block is changing thanks to a nonprofit called Black Women Build, which has been restoring some of those houses to create affordable housing. And as Amy explains, that has created another opportunity to unearth some of the neighborhood's history.
Behind a small brick row house in one of Baltimore's oldest black neighborhoods, a bunch of students and volunteers are hard at work excavating the backyard as a very vocal dog weighs in from across the alley. The group has painstakingly carved out a pair of trenches in a corner of the lot. They're searching for where the outhouse or privy would have been when the house was built in the late 1800s.
Because privy for most of the 19th century is the place you put your trash.
Adam Frakia, a professor of archaeology at the University of Maryland, is leading this urban dig. He says the hole or vault in the ground beneath the privy can be a treasure trove.
The great thing about privies is most people don't think about what they throw away. It's out of sight, out of mind, so it gives us an unbiased sample of what people have.
Those samples are preserved in layers.
You can read those layers through time, kind of like a layer cake.
One student learning to do that is Alexander Simonet. He's a junior sociology major at Morgan State University, a historically black college in Baltimore. And this is his first dig.
Almost my first time holding a shovel.
Frakia shows Simonet how to identify layers of soil by color.
What's the predominant color?
Reddish brown.
After hours of digging, the team still hasn't found the privy, but they have unearthed dozens of artifacts from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. A broken clay smoking pipe, a bottle marked liver oil, a doll's arm and tea set, and an etched piece of slate a child might have used to practice letters.
You know, think about the values of education, teaching. I mean, that tells a lot about the individuals here.
Individuals whose stories and circumstances are often overlooked by archaeologists, like the laborers, waiters, and drivers who lived in these alley houses between Baltimore's more prominent streets. Frakia says even something as mundane as a bone from a piece of meat can help paint a picture of economic life.
What type of cut are they getting? Are you getting high-end quality cuts, or are you getting, you know, mid-range, or things that don't have a lot of protein?
Census records show a woman named Sarah McGill rented this house from at least 1900 through 1940. Occupation, laundress. She had a daughter who might have owned that doll and tea set. The McGills were black, like most of their neighbors, in what by then was a deeply segregated city. Baltimore has the shameful distinction of passing the nation's first racial zoning law in 1910.
And this is not that many generations removed from right now. So that's what I think is important about telling this bit of history.
That's why Shelley Halstead, whose nonprofit owns the house now, was eager to have Frakia and his crew come here. She's executive director of Black Women Build Baltimore, which is rehabbing the house Sarah McGill rented all those years for another black woman to own.
I like that they're interested in who lived in these houses, who lived in these neighborhoods.
But it's more than that. She says overcoming the city's racist legacy requires really confronting it.
Oh, they used to have latrines out back, in, you know, back even into the 50s. And it's like, I wonder why, because the city wouldn't put sewer lines here. You know, you think people like in a hole?
Baltimore finally built a sewer system in the 1910s. But even 40 years later, thousands of houses still lacked indoor plumbing. Another expert on the dig is archaeologist Alexandra Jones, who sifts soil through a large screen. She's founder of Archaeology in the Community, aimed at bringing this kind of research into underserved neighborhoods and involving the people who live there.
Oftentimes, the communities that are most forgotten in the archaeological record tend to be these communities.
Jones says her group and this dig are part of a growing movement to open up the field, which is overwhelmingly white.
For me, as an African-American woman, it's super important to give voice back to those who've been omitted historically. In addition to that, making opportunities for students of color, women of color.
Women like Jordan Wallace, another student from Morgan State.
When you think about archaeology, you think about some ancient culture, some battlefield 1,000 years ago, when history is yesterday.
Wallace is 20 and grew up in Compton, California.
Literally digging in the ground and picking up things from the past, that kind of reaffirms who I am, who my people are, and I would love to learn more about it.
Wallace isn't planning to become an archaeologist. She wants to be a sports agent.
Hell of a sifter, though. I can sift some sand.
The students never did find the privy vault. It may have been destroyed when the water and sewer lines were finally put in, scattering the contents until someone cared to dig them up. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, an interview that Mick Mulvaney did with CNBC this morning. Mulvaney, you might remember, was the director of the Office of Management and Budget for President Trump. He was the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He was the acting chief of staff in the Trump White House. And until last night, he was the administration's special envoy to Northern Ireland.
I called Mike Pompeo last night, left him a note, told him that I'd be resigning from that. I can't do it. I can't stay.
Mr. Mulvaney has resigned with, and I'm checking my calendar here, 13 days left in the Trump presidency. All right, we got to go. Crammed a little bit too much stuff in today, so we're a little tight. Amir Babawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.